I'd like to welcome Jay Mertallo. He's a professor emeritus at the Ohio State University College of Pharmacy, also a clinical practice specialist for the American Society for Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition. And today, what I'd like to discuss with Jay is a recent article that he and a colleague of his, Phil Ayers, from the University of Mississippi and Baptist Health Systems, wrote with regards to parenteral nutrition safety. And this article appeared in Pharmacy Practice News. And I was just wondering if we could discuss various elements from that article today, Jay.
First, that's a pleasure for me to be here and talking on a topic. I think I mentioned it earlier that we've been working with parenteral nutrition safety for over 30 years.
Great. Well, I think I'd like to first start off with, I think we both know that parenteral nutrition is an extremely complex therapy. And as an expert, and as you said, you've been working with parenteral nutrition for three decades, I was wondering if you could walk us through some safety issues that have been associated with the prescribing, administration, and even compounding of parenteral nutrition.
When we go back historically and think about our original safety issues, I think about this when I describe it to my family members. I said, just imagine that what you ate for lunch, we put into a container and infuse intravenously into a patient, and it's safe and it's actually effective in maintaining their nutritional status. But when you think about it in those terms, the therapy itself is a complex prescription. It includes over 30 different ingredients or chemicals, maybe in some cases up to as many as 50 different ingredients, all of which have their own similar physical chemical characteristics. And so, we have to worry about how does it stay soluble? How does it remain stable? How does it remain sterile as well as compatible? And so all those issues fall into hand with regards to this one product. And with all those ingredients going into your vein, different than your gastrointestinal tract, you have to worry about how its osmolality. And I think that was the biggest concern. We wouldn't have parenteral nutrition if they didn't devise a catheter that could go into the subclavian vein, into the right atrium of the heart, and be able to infuse safely without causing vascular distress or thrombosis. And then the major other issues were hyperglycemia. But as we evolved, parenteral nutrition started to take on other aspects. Then we'll talk a little bit later probably on the lipid injectable emulsions as well as a pharmaceutical product that is very complex and takes knowledgeable individuals to make sure that it's infused for safe purposes and whatever. So that just being the product, you can see how we could think about safety issues just from the aspect of making sure that we're infusing a sterile, stable, and compatible formulation in individuals involved with that. And then when we go beyond that, I think the other interesting aspect with parenteral nutrition is that, it takes a system in order to administer it safely to a patient to keep problems from happening. And you already mentioned different parts or nodes or processes in that system that are important: the ordering process, the transcribing process, compounding, dispensing, delivery, and then administration to patients and monitoring. And I think unique to parenteral nutrition, it's not just one health professional, it's a group of health professionals or interdisciplinary group that touches that order or product at some point in time. And they all need to be knowledgeable about that. And we need to be able to communicate effectively across each one of those processes, that everyone that's doing a part of that process knows what to do and how to do it well.
As we've been talking about, Jay, the process for parenteral nutrition is extremely complex and errors are common, yet very often they're underreported. I was wondering if you could share your thoughts about this.
Well, I think the main thing is that, parenteral nutrition to be sterile makes it a drug. But most people look at parenteral nutrition as nutrition. And so most of the systems for reporting errors really involve medication errors. And if it's not really thought as a medication, that's not, that's going to deter people from reporting that whole process, the process, or even the patient harm systems that have occurred. Well, I think the main thing is that people look at parenteral nutrition as nutrition and not as a medication, and all the systems that are created to evaluate medication errors to make better practice recommendations really are focusing on medications and not nutrition. And so it's a confusing. People don't know where to report them. So if you get anything out of this discussion, you need to report parenteral nutrition errors through the same systems that we report medication errors from, and then we can help make better recommendations for it.
So for some people that may not be familiar with the different reporting systems for medication errors, could you kind of talk about what are the different methods that are available and how they're used to report these types of errors?
First off, the agency that really leads in this area is the Institute for Safe Medication Practices, abbreviated ISMP. So people work in healthcare have always seen ISP alerts and recommendations. And there's two systems that they use. One is the Medication Error Reporting Program that's called MERP. And that usually deals with more severe errors that most likely cause harm or death in a patient. They'll do a very intense investigation of that to do a root cause analysis of what the problem actually is, and then make recommendations for process changes or education that needs to occur to avoid it in the future. The other system is the MedMarX system, which is a system that a lot of institutions use just to report medication errors. It's not of as high intensity as the MERP, but it does report errors that occur. And they do classify the errors in a gradation of errors related to the errors that occur before it reaches a patient. That would be A through D. And then the errors that reach the patients would be A through H or E through H. And then the different grades with that are also related to whether it's caused harm or death in the patient, all the way down to not having any event whatsoever. So I look at that whole system as one of two ways. One is, you know, the safety issues where harm has occurred, where people are going to take action. And then the products where it has occurred prior to reaching the patient is more of a performance improvement process. If it goes on, it might lead into the harm area at some point in time, but usually it's how do you make the system better and more efficient and more effective for the people that are within the system in order to hopefully avoid safety issues in the future.
I know there's been some publications looking at the various nodes of the PM process and where errors occur most commonly. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, we've done a few of those ourselves. And really, the errors occur in the ordering process. Very few, but rarely some significant ones occur in the compounding process. And a lot of the errors occur in administration. When you look at administration errors, that's where most of the harmful events occur in relationship to that. Some of the best examples of that we've seen is from the lipid emulsions administered separate from parenteral nutrition, with people getting confused with parenteral nutrition versus the lipids. In some cases, the parenteral nutrition is given a peripheral vein rather than the lipid, and lipid given in the central vein, causing peripheral thrombosis, or just the infusion rates get confused so that the lipids infused at the dose of the parenteral nutrition infused at the lipid dose. So those are some of the common things that are, occur in relationship to those.
Jay, I know you've been part of the development of several versions of the Aspen Safe Practice guidelines and recommendations, and even some surveys with regards to clinical practice use patterns with parenteral nutrition products. I was wondering if you could update us on what some of the most pertinent publications or some of the most recent publications.
Well, there's been several, and there's actually been a parenteral nutrition safety section established on the Aspen website to keep all those in one place for people to refer to. I think one of the nicest papers that have come out is by Worthington, looking at the appropriate use for parenteral nutrition. And I think a lot of times we make errors because the wrong patients are receiving the therapy. But there's a lot of good basic information about the about parenteral nutrition, its indications, its utilization, and some of the safety issues that we've been talking about. We've had a couple of competence papers that have come out related to ordering parenteral nutrition, as well as compounding and preparation. The two papers that came out this year is related to the lipid emulsions because they're newer products, and we felt there'd be confusion with regards to dosing as well as just the products themselves and where they would best fit into our practice, realizing that just because they're white, they're not exactly the same. And the nice thing about it, it provides us some more liberal approaches towards dosing as well as different products to use for patients in different patient populations. We weren't restricted to just one product anymore. So I think those are the major ones that I can think of off the top of my head. One's coming out in the future on parenteral nutrition compatibility. I think I'm excited about that. Gordon, you've helped us work on that as well as one of the issues we think is important with our new products available is we don't probably know as much about the compatibility and stability as we should. And we need to work in tandem with the manufacturers to get the best information out there to the public as possible.
Well, you know, Jay, there's a lot of people are dealing with shortages now. And I was wondering if you could discuss some considerations with regards to how shortages impact not only errors, but safety, and what are some of the steps that clinicians can take to minimize these errors?
So we've dealt with shortages in parenteral nutrition products for a lot longer period of time than what we have now. And I think the classic one has been multivitamins. It's been a particular problem for a number of years. There's, you know, used to be only one supplier, and it's very difficult when you look at the raw materials, the vials that are used for the product, just the sterile process that's included with all of that, and all the different there's 12 to 15 different vitamins in that product, what things can go wrong with regards to its production. And that's usually where most shortages have come from, is a problem and product shortages and not another manufacturer that can pick up the slack with regards to being able to provide those products available to them. But one of the main things we found in the major shortage area, which was around 2009 to 2012, was that a lot of clinicians were having to make changes in products because of shortages, and errors were occurring because they weren't familiar with them. Well, Aspen's been working a number of years and trying to develop different recommendations and different information for clinicians to know more about parenteral nutrition so they can help, they can be helped with regards to product shortages and what can happen. One of the big things is we realized that over this period of time, we really have a generation of clinicians that never really were able to learn how to dose parenteral nutrition correctly because we didn't have enough products. And some of our interventions were in order to make sure the supply lasted so everyone that needed it actually got some, was to look at some processes of using reduced dosages or maybe using alternate day administrations like we've done with vitamins, which aren't the optimal thing, but and then also maybe reserving different products for high-risk patients like pediatric patients or patients on long-term home parenteral nutrition. And so one of the basic things that came out a few years ago was Aspen came out with dosing recommendations for parenteral nutrition for what is the optimal dosing for patients, not necessarily what's been practically done over the last 10 to 12 years. So I think that's one of the key things. And then the other thing was just knowing that we need to have better systems. There's been a number of publications that have come out from Aspen that have worked with safe practice recommendations, our parenteral nutrition safety recommendations that came out that I led in 1997, then again in 2004. We've got parenteral nutrition guidelines. I think the paper by Pat Worthington on the appropriate use of parenteral nutrition was also very well done. And it's they're resources that clinicians that don't have the experience or the training can go to help them make decisions. And even the papers that came out from the on PN competencies regards to ordering as well as compounding, parenteral nutrition is one of those things. So we're constantly looking for resources to fill in the gaps where we see inconsistent practices because of shortages or just because of lack of training of individuals and parenteral nutrition to give them the resources to improve the safety of their therapy.
You know, continuing on with this theme of shortages, I know now there are commercially available multi-chamber bags of parenteral nutrition that have that are available on the U.S. market. And I was wondering kind of what your guidance and recommendations are for using these as options to extemporaneously compound parenteral nutrition.
Well, there's a couple things. One is they're almost complete, and all the nutrients that are in there are in proportions that are appropriate for the patient's dosage for calories and protein. So the nice thing about it is a known quantity that you know if you're dosing a patient based on weight and caloric delivery, that you're going to give the patients what they actually need. It's like an enteral product in an IV bag, but you do have to add vitamins and trace minerals. So you do have that. The other is that we've had so many new products that have come available in the United States that some of the questions we've had is, does our compatibility and stability information actually apply to how we're doing parenteral nutrition right now? Because most of those compatibility and stability studies were done in the 80s and 90s with, in some cases, parenteral nutrition products that aren't even commercially available anymore. So the other nice thing about the commercially available bags is that you know what the compatibility and stability of those are if they're mixed together and used according to what the manufacturer's recommendations are. So I think those are two really strong things related to that. The other thing is the more number of additives you put in parenteral nutrition formulation, the more chance there is for error. You know, and we'll get to that when we talk about the actual errors we observed before. Omission of nutrients is probably one of the most critical and most frequent errors that occurs because people that are prescribing parenteral nutrition aren't trained to do it. You know, they like what the old academic training was, you see one, do one, teach one. And if you've done one, it means that you're competent at it. And that's not necessarily true.
Thank you. You know, it's interesting, you and I have been practicing for a really long time. And from the end of the 1980s to for about 20 years after that, there weren't any new products that were introduced into the U.S. market for parenteral nutrition. And then within the last 5 years, there's been several new lipid injectable emulsion products that were introduced into the U.S. market. And I was wondering if you could share maybe some important considerations that people need to take into account when using these products.
Well, the first thing is that they're not all the same. Just because they're white doesn't mean they're equal. And actually, I'm very excited to see the new products on the market because we've practiced for a number of years, a decade or longer, realizing that we only really had one lipid emulsion product to administer to our patients. And when you look at the product and how it's designed, I mean, it's a perfect source of essential fatty acids, but is it the best source for patients that are in a critical care unit or in long-term home parenteral nutrition patient, since it has such a high concentration of essential fatty acids? And there's always been a concern about the quote omega-6 fatty acid content of the product and how it produces supports production of stress molecules as well as problems with coagulation and immunity. Is that something that we're overdosing patients on? So there's and we've been watching our colleagues all over the world get newer formulations available with the concept being of limiting or reducing the omega-6 fatty acid content and never really eliminating it because you still need that as an essential fatty acid, but not in the amounts of what's delivered in with the old soy oil ILE product we've had for decades. And so that's the nice thing about it. Plus, we're starting also to see that in certain populations, maybe fish oil is something that's beneficial. Medium chain triglycerides might add a little bit more stability to the product, but reduce the omega-6 fatty acids to provide a reliable, quick source of energy for our patients for using fat as a calorie source. So there's a lot of reasons I'm excited to see the new products available. But as we've described it, each one of the products has a different composition. We've got the single oil emulsion, like the soy oil ILE. Then you've got the combination of oils, one that has olive oil and soy oil. And then the one that has a four oil, which is MCT, soy oil, fish oil, and olive oil as well.
Olive oil again.
And then you've got just the plain fish oil emulsion. So it gives us a lot more options to think about patients in different clinical scenarios of what products should be available to use. The other main thing too is it's an emulsion. It's a very complex formulation, has its own physical chemical characteristics. And one of the things we've always corrected people on is when we make TNAs or total nutrient admixtures is once you add the emulsion to it, it's no longer a solution. You can't call it a solution anymore. It's an emulsion. And there's characteristics of that you need to watch out for light, for heat, for temperature, for different ions in order to make sure that it stays stable for the intended period of storage administration to the patient. So there's different stability and compatibility characteristics you have to concern yourself with. And now that we have the different oils in there with the different characteristics, you need to know the product compatibility. The main thing I worry about is most of our compatibility and stability information that's published in our standard resources is was studied with soy oil ILE. And so people really need to know that they need to actually contact the manufacturer for stability compatibility information for the new oils and see if they're actually similar or characteristics of that. And that's probably one of the main concerns I have with that is making sure that information gets out and that people that are using compatibility and stability resources need to know what products that they're using in order to make a decision whether they say it's compatible or stable with that drug or with another nutrient that's added in the formulation.
Keep listening to hear more about the nuances of new lipid injectable emulsions and PN safe administration practices in part 2 of this discussion.